Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
All of the people you're about to meet, both the actresses and Tom Hooper, have done incredible work both on stage and screen. So Claire Bloom, who, of course, movie lovers fell in love with her appearance in Limelight, the Charlie Chaplin film, but she's done many films, including The Chapman Report and Richard III on stage, has done some wonderful interpretations of Blanche DuBois, and we are so thrilled that she is with us tonight. Please welcome Claire Bloom. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Ely also has some great stage credits, and she was in a production of Streetcar Named Desire, but in that case, it was her mother, Rosemary Harris, who played Blanche DuBois. She was a toddler, but she was that was her first performance. She won a Tony Award for her performance in The Real Thing. Her films include Pride and Glory and Sunshine, and please welcome Jennifer Ely. And if you happen to watch the Golden Globes yesterday and you saw Tom Hooper there and were thinking, is he really going to be in Astoria tomorrow? He'll explain how he did it. He has done a number of great films. He directed the HBO miniseries, the great miniseries, John Adams. And a kind of somewhat, I think, overlooked film, a wonderful movie called The Damned United. And of course, this has been a great triumph for him, this film of the King's Speech. And here he is, right from Los Angeles. Please welcome Tom Hooper.
What an absolutely stunning cinema.
Thank you. We think so too. We're happy with it, and you have a great and you're our first live people on stage to do Q&A. So, you all look quite alive.
We're very honored to be the very first Q&A.
I did want to ask about your trip from Los Angeles because I was wondering how you were going to make it here in time. You said.
I think I finished at the Golden Globe parties at 5 a.m. and got on a plane at 7 a.m. So that's how it's done.
And are off to you said Chicago and London and Los Angeles after that, right? Yeah.
But I promise you coherence at all times tonight.
That's pretty good. That's a high bar. Well, I'm wondering, of course, you're all enjoying, I think, the response to the film. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about what you think it is that people are responding to about this movie. It's done incredibly well, not just with the reviews and all the award nominations, but the audience response. It's made a lot of money for a film that maybe when people described the idea initially thought didn't think this was going to be a big moneymaker, a film about a stuttering king. So could you talk about what you think people responded to?
Shall I start?
Oh, sure.
I think they respond to the fact that a crippled man wins. You know, it's a very uplifting film. But I also have a theory of my own, and that is that people of my generation, and I don't think this refers to younger people, had the dream always that the Queen came to tea. And you thought, oh, this is very strange. The Queen, here's the Queen in my house. What do I do? And it brings you into that kind of relationship with these so-called mythical people, and I guess they are. That you would never have otherwise, a very intimate relationship with George VI and his queen. My theory may be absolute rubbish, but I kind of thought it meant something one time.
No, it sounds like a good theory, and you have one of the most delightful scenes in the film. When
exactly.
So could you talk maybe about that scene when you realize who's sitting there at your table when you come in?
Well, I mean, you all just saw it. So
right.
I don't know what else there is to say, really, except that it was a lot of fun to shoot because they're very funny, Helena and Colin and Jeffrey. They were very funny together. They had great rapport. And so it was a lot of fun to be there doing it with them. I don't know. I love that. It's also in the originally, and it was cut some, but originally it was more of a scene. There was more between Helena, between the queen and Myrtle. And actually Myrtle Logue, she loved to play bridge, and her bridge partner was George Bernard Shaw. And that was in it originally.
Could you talk about, well, I guess it may be your idea about what you think it is that is causing such a great response to the film.
It's interesting. I mean, in the UK, it's sort of gone from being successful into kind of strange phenomenon territory where in 8 days it outgrossed the entire box office of The Queen. And I think and it's been number one since it opened a week ago, and it's the highest grossing film for the distributor of all time. I think it's even kept pace with Harry Potter in its first week. I mean, you know, it's that kind of. And so, and explaining that, I don't know, I'm not sure I can, but I mean, I certainly. It's obviously speaking quite deeply to people. I think it's possibly something about the period. I mean, that was a period where you're coming out of a Great Depression and you're going into war, and we're coming out of a economic crisis facing various asymmetric threats to our security. So there's a sort of strange symmetry between the 30s and now. But I think in the end, people are responding to it because of that combination of humour and emotion. And the way I think when you're made to laugh, it opens you up emotionally more. And then when emotion comes, you have less defense against it. And it talks about, you know, the big themes of finding your voice and courage and friendship. And, you know, although it deals with the stammering, I mean, I think we all have blocks that lie between us and the best version of ourselves, whether it's shyness or insecurity or anger, you know, or stress or something physical. And a stammer is just a very profound version of a block that lies between a person and their best selves. And seeing this man overcome this and arrive at this best version of himself is hugely inspiring, because that's kind of what we're all involved with at some level throughout our lives.
In your answer, you talked about sort of the big social issues and sort of what's going on in the world at the time, and this yearning for kind of leadership, perhaps, but then these very intimate issues as well. And I think that's what's behind a lot of the fascination people have had with the idea of the royal family. There's certainly American audiences are very fascinated.
Well, I mean, it's very appropriate to be sitting here on Martin Luther King's birthday talking about the power of speech making. It's also ironic because when I first Googled the title of my own movie 2 years ago, all I got was references to Martin Luther King and I Had a Dream. And I feel slightly embarrassed that now if you put the King's speech into Google, we've unfortunately displaced the great Martin Luther King, and he's a little bit further down the menu. I think it's extraordinary, the power of communication. And I think the surprising thing about King George VI is that the very thing that you would have thought would have been a barrier, which is his stammer, became an asset, because subsequent to making the film, I've read these wonderful descriptions during the war of how the nation knew he stammered, and as they sat down, they were charged with the suspense of his stammer, and they used to sit and hope that he would get through it without failing and without stammering. And his continued ability to do that became a kind of metaphor for the war effort. It became a kind of talismanic thing that, you know, as long as he can keep getting through it, then we'll be okay. And the fact that his stammer, his disability actually became, and the overcoming of it became sort of connected with the idea of English endurance is very interesting.
I was curious how well people knew this story. I know you were quite a young girl, actually, when war broke out. But did you have an awareness of this particular story, this piece of history?
No, of course not. But I did know that the king stammered. I don't know how I knew that. You know, when as a child, you hear things, and that he was very much loved. I think probably yes, for the fact that he'd overcome this. Mm-hmm. And that of course, that he was there. You know, that they both stayed in Buckingham Palace during the war, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, I think it was known even to someone, you know, as young as I was.
And I think the other reason for its success is there is a delicious sense of discovery in the film, because, I mean, in England, yes, you know, aspects of King George VI's story are known, but no one really knew that the guy who helped him was this maverick Australian self-taught failed Shakespearean actor speech specialist called Lionel Logue. And in fact, when I started working on it, we knew so little about him. We didn't have a photograph of him. We didn't know his son's names. We had the Logue that David Sidler had wonderfully invented, based on really just footnotes in history books. And the real thrill of this film was that 9 weeks before the shoot, my wonderful production designer tracked down the grandson of Lionel Logue, Mark, who was living in London, 10 minutes from where I live. And in his attic, he had a filing cabinet, and in one of the drawers of the filing cabinet was some papers, and amongst those papers was a handwritten diary account of his grandfather's relationship with the king that no one knew existed, that no historian has ever read, that no member of the royal family has ever seen. And 9 weeks before the shoot, I have effectively a completely new primary source, an insight into King George VI that no one knew was there. And we set about, David set about furiously rewriting the script with all our suggestions to take advantage of this. And I think that the fact that we're not just doing, you know, the David and Wallace story, yet another version, where really there's no new information. All you could do if you told the abdication story was take a new angle, but there's no new information, whereas we actually had new information, and that's very rare. Some of the best lines in the film are written by King George VI and Lionel Logue. And one example would be at the end of the big speech, Lionel turns to the king and says, "You still stammered on the W." And the king says, "Well, I had to throw in a few so they knew it was me." Those lines last spoken out loud by King George VI and Lionel Logue. A direct quote from the diary.
And this was a stage production?
Yes, I mean, and it was an unproduced stage production that a fringe theatre was trying and failing to produce. So that's how unlikely the whole thing was.
So tell us how, I mean, I have to ask how you put this cast together. This is about one of the most amazing ensembles you could imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I did sit in the rehearsal room and look across the table and think, well, you know, not only is it Colin Firth, Geoffrey Rush, Helena Bonham Carter, Guy Pearce, it's Sir Michael Gambon, it's Sir Derek Jacobi, it's the great Claire Bloom, it's Jennifer Ely, it's Anthony Andrews, who you may remember from playing Sebastian in Brideshead Revisited many years ago, an iconic performance in British television. It's Timothy Spall, and the cinematic and theatrical history in rehearsal room was formidable. And I think, I don't know whether it's the same in America, but it is amazing in England how you can get actors of this calibre, frankly, not working on, you know, working for less than they're meant to come in and play two scenes or three scenes, and you can have that kind of level of talent across the board. And it's a very special thing about the English ensemble tradition that you can work in that way.
I'd like to open it up and take some questions from the audience. We have very good acoustics in here, so raise your hand and if anybody has a question. I think Ray in the back. No, yeah, you're just waving. Okay, right here.
I have a question for the director.
That's me.
What initially drew you to the story?
What drew you to the story?
It's because it's the fact that I'm myself half Australian, half English, and I grew up in London. And I'd for a long time been looking for either an Australian story to tell or something that dealt with that very particular relationship between the English and the Australians. And of course, that material is hard to come by. And when I read this script, it spoke to me partly because one of the narratives of my childhood was my Australian mother, dealing with the effects of my father of his childhood. My father lost his dad in the war at the age of 2. My grandfather was a bomber navigator killed in 1942 at the tender age of 30. As a result, my dad was packed off to full-time boarding school at the age of 5. And, you know, it was the era of cold baths, even in the middle of winter, outside loos with no doors, corporal punishment, all those great British educational innovations. and my mother was sort of brilliant within the family at saying, obviously this sort of affected your father and it's up to us as a family to unlock him. And she was kind of in a much, you know, gentler way than the film, the kind of Lionel Logue to my dad. And I went from having a father who was not brilliantly connected to a father who now says, you know, you're one of my ribs, and that's really thanks to my mum. So for me, it was a chance to tap into this very strong memory of the Australian freedom in unlocking an Englishman through the story of a king and a therapist.
Okay, right down here. Okay, were there differences in working with Colin Firth and Geoffrey Rush, and what was it like working with them?
I mean, they've got quite different energies. I mean, Geoffrey is like a five-year-old child with the most unbridled love and enthusiasm and wide-eyed wonderment for his craft. And it's and you know, there was not a night where he wouldn't have stayed up all night discussing the next day's work. And, you know, Colin is more of the reserved Englishman that you'd imagine. And one of the delights of the rehearsal room was in a way, seeing a parallel to what happens in the film of Geoffrey's infectious enthusiasm sort of breaking down some of Colin's sort of inhibitions, I suppose, to inhibitions to being openly enthusiastic. And he quickly became as enthusiastic as Geoffrey. But I think, I mean, it's hard to answer it in general. I mean, they're both... I mean, you know, there's interesting sort of exchanges that happen. I mean, Geoffrey is brilliant at using his body. He was trained at Le Coq in Paris, the famous mime school, when Geoffrey was in his 20s. And he talks in terms of the silhouette that a character creates, you know, the line, the shape of the figure that's cut. And I found when I was filming him, you know, sometimes, you know, I'd do a close-up first and I'd think, I love what he's doing with his hands. So then I'd go into a mid shot and I think I'm missing the whole shape he's making in the doorway. So then I'd go even wider. And I would end up sort of changing my shooting style to capture that sense of the shape. And then Colin, in a way, not coming from the same tradition, it then made me think about the way, the shape of Colin's body. And you know, rather than sitting in a chair very erect, I got him to sort of fold into the corner of a chair and crumple into himself, and the way, you know, and sit in the corners of sofas, and when he stood to stand in a geeky way, and I think it was having Geoffrey there and being reminded of how powerful the body is that made me push Colin to use it more. At the same time, I think sort of Colin's extraordinary minimalism. I mean, because he's an actor. When I think of his work, I tend to think of him as someone who really can be incredibly minimalist. I think probably brought Geoffrey into a more minimalist place. And so I think the thing that's really interesting when you're working with a number of actors is allowing one to learn from the other and controlling that exchange in an interesting way.
Could you talk about Claire? You work, Ms. Bloom. You work with Michael Gambon, one of my favorite actors. The scenes between you and him, I think, were very touching, and you convey in your performance as Mary convey a certain sense of what the royal family is supposed to be and behave. Could you talk about those scenes or your part in the film?
There was very little.
No, I know, but it was good. You made
a
lot.
It's very hard for me to talk about it.
We want to know how you understand the English royal family so well.
I'm by no means a royalist. I don't know that I understood. I understood up to a point that this poor woman was damaged, as I think they all are down to the present day, and that her life had been hell, frankly. Can you imagine being married to George V? Wasn't he said, I was afraid of my father, and I'm damn sure my children are going to be afraid of me. I bet she was afraid of him too. Apparently she was told by him that every night at dinner she had to dress in the full gear, the pearls, the tiara, the whole thing. I don't think she had any life with him, I doubt. And I suppose a certain affection builds up if you've lived together for 60 years. But I don't know what kind of affection it could have been. I was very sorry for her. And perhaps that made the little that I do interesting, because I didn't want to play her, you know, as a matriarch, whatever that is. I did see this extraordinary film, which you probably saw, called The Lost Prince, about her son, one of her many sons, who was an epileptic. Mm. That was considered in those days that the royal family could have such a child, a total disgrace, and he was very well treated, etc., etc. He was completely isolated. She went to see him as much as she could, and obviously this was great suffering for her. And he had his own household and a devoted nurse, but he was kept completely secret, completely apart from his brothers and sisters, and probably his father never saw him. So all I'm really saying in a roundabout way is that one feeds that kind of background into this so-called or appearing ice woman that she really wasn't. She was a very damaged and abused woman, I would think.
But I also think that's what's so extraordinary about what Claire does is that sort of tip of the iceberg acting where you suggest a whole world and a whole life when you don't have the advantage of when you're playing a lead where you've got so much to structure it. And actually I think it's very hard to come in and suggest the complexity of a lived life without actually having lots of signposts. And
I was terrified, because I usually, I mean, of course I've played small parts, not perhaps as small as this. First of all, they say, no, there's no such thing as a small part, and I think that's true. And secondly, I'm used to playing something that has a little more background. But luckily, this did have a historical background, even if it was not such an imaginative background as one would want to bring to a part that you can think through, as an arc. But I sound like the Queen now. I was able to bring to it the little that I could find out about Queen Mary.
And would you tell the story that I only found out about 2 days ago, Claire?
Oh, yeah, I seem to have forgotten to tell you that I I had actually met, or was presented to, I think the expression is, Queen Mary. When I was, I'd kind of forgotten it. When I was 18 and in a play in London called Ring Round the Moon, and she came to see it and sat in the royal box, I presume at a matinee, she must have had her tea in the royal box. I mean, it was a world that was very different. And we were taken, it was Paul Scofield, myself, and the great Margaret Rutherford, to the box and presented to this lady, where one curtsied or fell on one's face or something like that. And all I vaguely remember is these incredible earrings. She had wonderful big diamond earrings that were, and in time confuses everything, and I probably put on her head the toque with the feather that she didn't wear, but I had seen in photographs. I mean, it's a long time ago.
These are great earrings, by the way.
Yeah,
just noticing.
I like earrings.
Could you talk about the pleasures of working within the genre of the costume film or period films? Or any particular?
Don't use the word costume.
Okay, well, there are costumes. It's a genre that you've certainly made very fresh and vital, and you've worked in it in a number of films, actually, right? Some of your earliest.
Are you asking me?
Yeah, well, I was starting to.
I was going to say one thing, because I find this phrase costume drama very offensive. And the reason and this is my theory about the phrase costume drama, that it's actually a phrase used by male critics to describe mainly adaptation of literature written by women. Because if you think about it, it tends to be about Jane Austen, it tends to be about George Eliot. It tends to be about the Brontes. You hear it, you know, if you don't tend to describe an adaptation of Tolstoy as a costume drama in quite the same way. And I'm suspicious that there's a sort of undercurrent of sexism, which is basically saying these extraordinary authors, Eliot, Austen, with their profound knowledge of the human condition, that an adaptation of their work is really as surface as about the clothes that are chosen people to wear. And I think it sets up a terrible sort of, I mean, as a director, you almost feel like you have to overcome it. You have to kind of, oh God, you know, but the people think I'm just making a costume drama, and I'd love to sort of unpack how that term even was arrived at.
I always wondered when people, because I do hear about Pride and Prejudice, that when it's described as a drama, because I think it's a romantic comedy, really, and the fact that they're dressed in clothes of another time is sort of, you know, it's maybe part of it, but it's not. It's pretty irrelevant, really.
That's right. And this film has wonderful comic scenes, one of which, of course, notoriously got it an R rating, the cursing scene.
Yeah, I mean, in you know, in the UK, this is a family movie. In Australia, it's a family movie. In Canada, it's a family movie. Sadly, in the United States of America, it is to be ranked as exactly the same rating as Saw 4 in 3D.
But meanwhile, Meet the Fockers is a family movie.
That's right. Okay, right over there.
Suggest that, you know, King Edward and Mrs. Simpson had sympathies for the Nazis. That was sort of new to me. True?
Well, it's interesting. I went down the route of making that theme much stronger, and then the historical advisors pointed out that there was a very influential documentary in England called Britain's Nazi King about Edward VIII, which suggested that there was some kind of possibility of a collusion between Hitler and Edward, where, you know, Edward would come back to the throne in a country ruled by Hitler. And sadly, for the people trying to make exciting documentaries, when you actually look at this a bit more closely, it is a gross sort of exaggeration. I think Edward, like Chamberlain and like Baldwin, made the same mistake, which he felt you could reason with him. And it was a question of going to see him and sitting down and talking man to man. And he was an appeaser, for which he's also condemned. And I find this way that we condemn the appeasers difficult, because, you know, if I imagine myself in that period, 1938, 1939, you're thinking, 20 years ago, 1 million Englishmen lost their lives in a world war. The idea of me being pro a world war or being pro-military would be abhorrent. I mean, I would have been a complete appeaser. And although I would have been on the wrong side of history, I would think it'd be unimaginable to be vigorously advocating a return to war 20 years after such a worldwide catastrophe. But I think the mistake that they all made in the end is beautifully articulated by Baldwin when he said, "Well, none of us, you know, I did not understand the complete absence of moral feeling that Hitler had." And, you know, in a story about disability where you have King George VI suffering a speech disorder, you have Roosevelt in a wheelchair, you know, Hitler's disability was clearly internal and fairly problematic.
Okay, let's take a few more. There's one right over there. There's been any reaction from the royal family or input?
I mean, the frustration is, you know, really what I wanted to do was sit down and have tea with the Queen. And, you know, and say, "Tell me about your father. What do you remember about your father?" But, of course, it's the one thing you can't do. And it is very frustrating to feel that, particularly for someone like me, when I really want to make it as truthful as possible. And I know she could have told me things in 5 minutes that would have altered how I'd made the film. and I know there are things I must have got wrong which she could have corrected in a moment. But you know, they have a policy of kind of non-involvement in fictional representations of their family. If you're making a documentary, I think you can get access. But the truth is, you know, we still do not know if the Queen has watched The Queen. And if she did, what she thinks. And that's a few years ago now, so that I may never know, you know, what she thinks of this. But if anyone ever finds out, for God's sake, come and find me.
Okay, right over here.
Just to follow up on that point, your opinions of the royal family at the start of the movie or when you started making the movie change from when you finished making the movie?
I think it did slightly in the sense I'm probably more Republican than I mean I'm probably a sort of I'm possibly supportive of them for practical reasons like you know, given we live in sort of entertainment UK, they're an incredible asset in terms of sort of people's obsession with those kind of stories, and they obviously bring a massive income into the UK in terms of tourism. So I mean, that practically, but I think what I found fascinating about doing it was that the attack you would use is that it is unacceptable to have this kind of inherited privilege celebrated through the monarchy at the heart of our country. And yet what's so fascinating about the story of King George VI is it completely debunks the notion of privilege and renders it rather inadequate as an attack. Because, you know, okay, his childhood, well, neglected by his parents, abused by his nanny, you know, a left-hander retrained as a right-hander. I mean, that it's definitely not a privileged childhood. Becoming king, in his case, a nightmare, not a privilege. And the fact that the attack of privilege is kind of dismantled in the case of him, I think, is a tremendously strong reason why the royal family has survived so robustly. Because, you know, his daughter is in his tradition, and you look at her life, and I think it is privileged. I mean, every day of the year she's booked doing duties. I mean, you know, I might complain about doing junkets in my film. Her life is a permanent junket. Her life is a permanent, at least I can express my opinions on things. It's a permanent junket where she can't express opinions on anything because it would be considered offensive. So, I mean, you know, so I think, weirdly, like many things in life, going back a generation, you understand more about the survival of institutions than necessarily focusing on the present.
Okay, just over here.
Question from Azili.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Well, I don't know. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Jeffrey. Oh, I mean, basically everything I did there was with Jeffrey, and there was more. So our marriage felt like more of a marriage, because there were other scenes and there were other things, and we rehearsed, and it did feel like we spent a lot of time together. So it did feel like a very, I think it felt very, I had a real sense of Lionel and Myrtle. And I think Jeffrey did too. And I don't know, they fit well together. I wasn't aware that we were different species, I suppose. I mean, he's such a, you know, he's such an amazing man, and he's an amazing actor, and his Lionel was so vital and big, as is, you know, Jeffrey and his spirit and his personality. But no, I wasn't aware. See, that's a thing that you have an advantage now, and Tom hasn't had the advantage, thank goodness, of seeing the overall. All I saw was my, you know, what was on my plate, which was Myrtle, and so I wasn't aware of how she fit in with everybody else.
And so you didn't feel like she was supposed to be the kind of down-to-earth one, where he's, you know, he's obviously sort of a dreamer through the film, somebody he wants.
You know, because I think Tom is so good that he would, that was not something that I would have known about. What we
talked about was the dynamic between them, which, you know, you can't play, something so abstract, but the dynamic between them. And there actually was this whole thing that I suppose was part of it was that she wanted to go home. Hmm. And so that was part of the reason why he kept his word to the king in not telling her, letting her in on what he was doing, was because, of course, once he has his relationship with the king, then they're not going to go home to Perth. They're going to be stuck there in England. So there was all that. And so basically, I think they clearly made the right decision to cut all that. But what's great is you kind of get what you're left with is that there's something real going on. You're just not quite sure what it is.
It's interesting. I mean, there's a scene that we cut straight after Jennifer discovers the king and queen in the parlor, where the sort of the mistruth or the untruth leads to conversation. It leads to her basically saying that she'd always thought they were going to go home, and now because of this, they'll never go home. And Jennifer got very emotional in it, and it was very fascinating for me is when I was editing it, because Jennifer's emotional power in that scene was so unbelievably strong that it almost upset the balance of the ecology of the movie, because the main character in the film is finds it so hard to emotionally express himself that if you have her character being that powerfully emotionally expressive at that moment in the architecture, it has an uncomfortable relationship to this theme, that this incredible tension about the inability to express emotion. And in the end, when you're making a film about the inability to exercise demons through the free expression of emotion, your the open display of emotion is something you have to be very careful about. And it's very fascinating, and that's what's so interesting about editing, is those things you don't see at the time become important. But oddly, I don't regret having shot and cut some stuff, because I think it actually meant that our sense of that marriage was much stronger than if we'd only shot the scenes that were in the film.
Yeah, I really do think that's true.
Okay, we'll take one more from the audience over here.
You've each mentioned rehearsal and the rehearsal process.
Great.
I'm just wondering how much time was actually spent rehearsing for this movie, and for Miss Ely and Miss Bloom, was it different than other movies you've been a part of, more beneficial? What do you think?
I mean, overall we had 3 weeks of rehearsal, which is incredibly unusual on a film. I mean, you know, normally you struggle to get a week. One of the things that made me happiest at the end was that Jeffrey said that it was the only time in his life that rehearsing for a film had been like rehearsing for a play, in terms of feeling like we'd completely pulled it apart and rebuilt it and analysed every line. Having said that, both Claire and Jennifer were because of availability, were less able to do quite as much rehearsal as that. But for me, it's vital, and for me, it's where you workshop a script. And the script was wonderful to start with, but there was not a line that we didn't pore over and think, can we improve? And a lot of the way, I think, in the end, I arrive at character with actors is actually through incredibly close interrogation of the text, because the choice, you know, to me, choice of vocabulary, choice of a single word, tells you something about a character, and through workshopping a script, it's often a very good way to get into a very specific discussion about character, which doesn't involve an actor constantly putting a character on his feet. And you know, because I didn't want Colin to have to be doing lots of, you know, stammering rehearsals where I wanted to keep that fresh energy for the moment. So it's also a way to get very detailed about character without exhausting it as a piece of performance.
It was, I mean, I was only there for, I just came in at the end, so I was there for 2 days of rehearsal, but then the rehearsals every day of filming were also vigorous, and it really was, I think it was the only, I haven't done that much, but it was the only job I have done that involved filming, that involved rehearsal, where it actually, I think, made a huge difference to the work and to the finished product.
I'm being very silent because I wasn't there. I wish I had been, because I think it's such a wonderful thing to have rehearsal time before a film. And I have done few, but some films where we have had that, and time to really analyze the script and to talk between us about the characters, etc., etc. In this particular instance, I missed out on that, and I'm sorry, because I think it's often the most exciting part of a movie. I still, as a stage actor, cannot get over the fact that you go into a film, onto a film stage, meet someone you've never seen before and do the scene. I mean, I know that's the way it's done. I think it demands an awful lot of skill to do that without real preparation. And that's, of course, the way things are done now. I mean, this was a huge exception. Must have been a gigantic exception. It wasn't so much in my day because things weren't that expensive, blah, blah, blah. But for instance, a television, you're just thrown into it without a chance to do any work other than the work you have to have done yourself, which is a very long-winded way of saying I wasn't there.
Just as a last question, and this is sort of a big one, but if you could talk about your approach to style on the film, or what you sort of had in mind artistically, because I think it's a great accomplishment. There's a real intimacy to the film. There's sort of an epic scope to the film, but there's a real intimacy in the way you film. And I know maybe there are things you do with the type of lens you use and things like that, but there's a real strong artistic control that you feel in every frame of the film.
No, I certainly wanted to subvert what I perceive to be cliches of films about royals. I mean, I know directors can become intoxicated by the pageantry, by the theatricality, by gold and gilt and words like lavishness. And I wanted to get away from that and find a much more austere centre to the picture. And I felt that all the research I did backed me up. And I'll give you, you know, a specific example, which is that the script I started with had Bertie being dressed in royal finery, in a plumed hat and a uniform and a sword, and he went to Wembley where he goes on a big canopied stage, and his father's there, and he's dressed in a plumed hat and a sword. And then I found a little bit of archive footage of the real Wembley exhibition, and he's just wearing a black overcoat and a black hat, and he's dressed identically to every other man in the stadium. He's an everyman figure. His father's not there. There's no canopied stage. The day is grey and smoggy and rainy. Wembley looks like it's falling apart, even though it's only built 2 years before. And out of that came this image of a man dressed in black against a dirty brick wall, looking scared out of his wits, which is how we meet the Duke of York. And I like this idea of there being no barrier between us and him, that he's a human first and his role comes second. I think the other thing, as I became very, you know, I realized early on that the dominant language of the film had to be the close-up, because stammering is best revealed in close-up. It's through that shot you see the pain in the eyes and the poignancy of the struggle. And knowing that, it was all therefore about how to find a cinematic way of handling the close-up. And I chose to shoot the close-ups on, you know, particularly with Colin and Jeffrey, on quite wide lenses, so the camera was maybe, you know, that far away from them. And by using wider lenses, it keeps the physical space in the frame all the time. You know, the classic Hollywood long lens close-up abstracts the face from the background. It's just an out of focus mush. Whereas here, the set is always part of it. And why that was important to me is I was trying to find a visual analog for what stammering is, and I felt that stammering is about inhabiting silence and absence and nothingness. And so I became preoccupied by this notion of framing Colin's face in relationship to negative space, so in relationship to big empty walls, to big distressed walls, you know, to big nothings, while with Jeffrey, you know, he's always framed against the clutter of the consulting room, the fireplace, the books, the equipment. So Colin, you have a sense of alienation against these stark walls. Sometimes he's hunkered down in the corner of frame, and Jeffrey is always an image of warm domesticity, and that structural division is quite clearly delineated.
Thank you. Well, you've made an acclaimed movie, but it's also a really great audience film, and I know everybody appreciated it. So thanks for all of you, to all of you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.